Welcome to episode 298 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. Bill 50, better known as the Sustainable Jobs Act, is off to the Senate of Canada for its final review. To help me better understand what is in the act, whether it's likely to achieve the government's objectives, and why it's been so controversial, I'm joined by Megan Gordon of Pembina Institute. So welcome to the interview, Megan.
Thanks so much, Markham. Great to be here.
Well, we have not talked about on this podcast or in other, you know, columns and stories that we do at Energy Media. We haven't talked about this enough. And I don't know why, because it was hugely controversial. It started out as a Just Transition Act, and then the whole definition of just transition got hijacked. You know, it somehow got turned into meaning that the government wanted to shut down existing fossil fuel-based industries. And maybe just, we should say maybe hydrocarbons, like oil and gas extraction, because I think everybody agreed that coal has to go. And so that wasn't so controversial, but you know, Premier Daniel Smith in Alberta was saying that it, you know, they were Justin Trudeau and the Liberals, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, wanted to, you know, shut down Alberta's big oil and gas industry. That really, I never heard that from, well, not from many people who were promoting this. So maybe let's start at that sort of 35,000 foot level. And can you give us a little bit of background on how this, you know, Just Transition Act and how we wound up with the Sustainable Jobs Act?
Yeah, absolutely. So this, you know, this concept of just transition really dates back to the 80s and, you know, the 70s, even as far back in Canada, where the labor movement really coined this term, which I think, of course, you know, it's not the most intuitive term for a lot of folks, but it has its roots with, you know, the working class talking about some of the kind of changes that they were starting to see, particularly in the resource industry, and needing and advocating for government to consider them in terms of what kind of changes were forthcoming, ensuring that there was like a robust social safety network in place to sort of catch the folks that were displaced through some of these changes. And so it sort of took a backseat for a while. And now this term's really reemerged post 2019, or when we had this massive climate agreement and all of these new, or sorry, what was it, 2016?
2015 for the Paris Agreement.
Exactly. So we've seen this reemergence since that time. And then when the governments of Alberta and Canada decided to accelerate the phase out of coal-fired electricity generation, there was a push again from the Canadian Labour Congress and many other unions in impacted sectors to really have Canada put in place a plan for workers. And there was a task force that was developed. It was traveled across all these different coal-fired regions. And then there was this bigger commitment now that we're seeing, you know, more ambition around climate and more changes from the global economy affecting Canadian workers and the economy. There's this push again to have real serious legislation put in place that holds the government to account on its promises.
Yeah, and put some resources in place to help workers transition into new jobs. The phase out of coal was actually, in many quarters, is viewed as a great policy success. I mean, you know, the labor movement, the federal government and some provincial governments worked very closely in putting together a process, while not perfect, was, I think, generally considered to be fairly successful in helping people either retrain, get new jobs. Sometimes there was a bridge from, you know, for older workers who maybe, you know, thought they would take early retirement. So there was a pension bridge there. I mean, it is generally thought to be a good approach. And I think that a lot of folks who supported a just transition thought if we can take that approach to other regions and other industries, and it kind of blew up, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that the coal transition is a good case study. The critiques from the folks on the ground, I think, were mostly around the fact that this commitment came a little too late, right? And it's change is really hard. And then having conversations about change well in advance of, the ripple effects taking place is another thing. So, we're dealing with something on a much bigger scale. The coal industry was really only a few thousand people in Alberta, and then, even fewer across Canada. So, talking about just transition, both from kind of what industries and workers are going to be impacted, but also how do we get our feet under us to prepare and ensure the workforce is prepared for the jobs that will be coming in the future.
I think the reason the opponents to just transition were successful is because they objected to the idea of any transition at all. And there has emerged, I think, and actually it happened after the just transition controversy of a couple of years ago, but there has emerged this different models of the energy transition. So I've written extensively about this, so I'll just give you a brief recap. The World Petroleum Congress last September in Calgary, the Alberta government, Premier Danielle Smith came out very, very strongly in favor of the OPEC and Saudi Arabia slow energy transition narrative. Oil demand doesn't peak until 2045, and then there's a long plateau, then there's a long decline. So basically, oil and gas are with us in Canada for decades and decades and decades. And so you can see where any talk of transition at this point would be threatening to people who hold that worldview. But then there is emerging, and I think it's almost become mainstream, this view of the International Energy Agency's announced policies take, where we're going to see peak oil demand in 2030, a fairly short plateau, and then a decline, by before 2035. Which has all sorts of implications for oil and gas in Canada, but particularly in Alberta. Now we're seeing, in light of what China's doing, the emergence of the fastest energy transition narrative. The Rocky Mountain Institute and some of these other organizations that are promoting that are have a little different view of the energy transition. And for those folks, they either argue that oil has peaked already globally, or very soon will, and the changes that the Sustainable Jobs Act are being put in place that act anticipates are here already. And that changes the conversation entirely. Now, if we were talking about in coal getting started late, if the Rocky Mountain Institute is correct, we're in the same position all over again. So you can see why for non-Canadian listeners, and we have quite a few of them, you can see now why this is so hugely controversial. The slow transition folks, leave it alone. We don't have to worry about this for decades. This is premature. And at the other end of the spectrum are the folks that we can't get this quick enough because we're already dealing with this on the ground. Is that, from your point of view, a fair way to kind of frame the conversation?
Yeah, I think you bring up some really interesting points. The act itself, I think it's important to note, it's really just a framework that sort of sets up the Government of Canada to put in place an internal architecture that helps them coordinate across different policy areas and really plan for the future. So whatever anticipated direction, whatever pace of transition occurs, it really just helps us ready ourselves for the future. And the other point I'll make here is it's not only just what impacts we're looking at, it's how do we, make sure our communities are more resilient to some of the boom and bust cycles that we've seen in the past. And Premier Smith herself has said, we need to get off the resource roller coaster. And so that comes with a lot of disruption and volatility. And that means massive layoffs occur every, in response to some of these global trends that we don't have any control over. So diversifying our economies and really capitalizing on some of the natural advantages that Canada has in the clean energy supply chain, as we compete with some of our neighbors and allies for some of these economic opportunities, that's really what this act can achieve once we start to see some of those key mechanisms put in place.
Well, let's talk about this because the Pembina Institute did a Sustainable Jobs Act blueprint, part one and part two, and giving recommendations to the government about what should be in the act. So, based on that, were you pleased with what you saw come out of the House of Commons, or not so pleased?
I think we're really pleased to see some progress on this. I think once the act is put in place, that's where we start to see the really meaningful investments that we want to have happen in a lot of different areas. I think having some coordination across energy policy, workforce development, regional development, that all gets started with the creation of this act. And so we see three key structures, and we're really happy with seeing those in place. So first of all, there's the Sustainable Jobs Secretariat, and they're going to be housed out of Natural Resources Canada and will have the responsibilities of bringing all those different government departments together to coordinate on the file. There's also a Sustainable Jobs Partnership Council, and that is a really great accountability and engagement mechanism. It brings together experts across industry, Indigenous groups, labor, and other experts, and they are and similar to the Net Zero Advisory Body in terms of climate policy. They advise the government on what kind of priorities and actions are best placed. And that's very much in line with our vision around the Sustainable Jobs Blueprint. We outline what we feel would be kind of those kind of key areas. And that was in partnership with the Canadian Labour Congress. So we're hopeful that we have an opportunity to engage with the Partnership Council and do a little, reprioritization exercise through that. And then lastly, there's these 5-year incremental action plans. And so that really sets us up, again, kind of in tandem with the emissions reductions plan that we also see every 5 years. That's really where we anticipate those investments happening. So new investments in training, new, relationships and coordination and work with the provinces, things of that nature.
I want to talk about one of the recommendations that came out of part two of your blueprint. Develop a net zero industrial policy that creates conditions for thriving clean energy industries. To my way of thinking, this was the most important one of all of them. And there's some context needed here. There's a huge debate going on right as we speak in the EU and the US pushing back against China's heavy, heavy subsidization of clean energy manufacturing. So solar panel manufacturing and wind turbines and electric vehicles and batteries and heat pumps. The government in China has subsidized those and supported them in other ways, sort of non-subsidy ways, and allowed because they wanted them to scale up to a global level, drive down costs, which clearly in most of those sectors, that's been accomplished. And then go out and compete in international markets. And of course, you can imagine the EU and the US governments are saying, hang on a second, this is dumping. And just yesterday, John Podesta, the US climate envoy, was in New York saying that the US government's putting in a task force and it's looking at what it calls carbon dumping. And what that means is China has 50, 60% of its electricity that basically, powers these factories comes from coal. And so what the US is saying is when we buy your products that you've made for, with this coal, we're buying those embedded emissions. And we were not going to do that anymore. And it's a very clever way, if you look at it from one point of view, very clever way of keeping out the very competitive Chinese EV makers, Chinese battery makers, and so on. And the US and the EU are way down this road and have been now for the last 3, 4 years. And it seems like Canada, I mean, we're just talking about setting up net zero industrial policy tables, which then take time to set up, and then you have conversations, and then you make recommendations for policy. Then government does or doesn't implement the policy recommendations. I mean, this takes years, and we just seem to be really, if we were behind before, and we are behind right now, we're going to be, by the time we do all this talking, we're going to be even further behind. And that's my take on the broad subject of clean energy industrial policy, but I was just wondering how you would respond to that.
There's so many different tools, I think, that are available to decision makers within this suite of, or this, kind of notion of industrial policy. And so I agree, you know, when you kind of put it in that context of formal industrial policy with all of its complexities and neatly packaged together is something that might take some time, but we're already seeing the government of Canada taking some steps towards that. And we saw some commitments and reaffirmed commitments come out in Budget 2024, which was released yesterday. And things like investment tax credits will spur investments in key industries, and especially, you know, from a sort of sustainable jobs, just transition, ensuring worker justice, and maximizing the social benefit of those investments, having the strings and the labor conditions that are attached to those are really, really important things for workers. And that's what we're really hoping that we can achieve through the Sustainable Jobs Act and this Partnership Council. So when there's workers' voices at the table, that's when we start to see these really clever policy solutions get put in place that not only spur investment in some of those kind of key industries, those burgeoning industries where Canada has an advantage, but also to see, you know, good jobs that support communities, that support families, that ideally are, you know, protected with unions. And, you know, I think the other thing too is approaching regional or industrial policy, you really need a regional lens to that. And I think the Alberta Federation of Labour put out a great report, the Skate to Where the Puck is Going report, which maybe you have or have not had a chance to chat about on this podcast, but they have some action items that have really, you know, they've talked to workers in the province and spoken with them about what their vision is for the future, and that they have some great ideas there too. So it can re yeah, there's lots of different tools available and lots of different ways to approach industrial policy, but I think we have a good little start underneath us already.
I hate to say this, Megan. I was the lead author on that report.
What? I'm shocked.
Exactly. So, you know, I come at this from a particular perspective of knowing what the big players are doing at the global level, and but not only that. I had a ch and I want to get a chance to address your comments about having workers at the table, which I think is a really good idea, but I interviewed a fellow named Dr. Kwesi Amofo, who is the Bloomberg NEF's head of mining and metals. This is 2022. And I said, I've told this anecdote on the podcast before. I asked Kwesi, I said, well, you know, Alberta's got lots of potential for critical minerals, not only mining, but also smelting and refining, which is mostly controlled out of China right now. And I said, surely we've got like a decade, at least till 2030. And he said, no, you have 2 to 5 years. He said, because what Canada doesn't understand is that while it has dithered, the other really aggressive emerging economies like Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, India to some extent, Saudi Arabia, and some of the other Middle Eastern countries have all been putting enormous amounts of capital at work to attract these factories and to build their own industrial bases and put in place industrial policy. Said, you've only got 2 to 5 years. That's then the window's going to close. That's how fast things are moving at the global level, which is partly what informs, you know, my take that we are dithering and muddling through as we always do as Canadians, while the world stampedes to, in this new direction. But that's context for for my listeners. But I think you're right. I mean, having workers at this isn't just about capital deployment. The IEA put out this huge report last year about opportunities on glo for workers in clean energy industries. And it says that far more of those jobs will be created than will be lost in fossil fuels. And I think that is a good framing for Canada, particularly in Alberta, where, you know, we've already lost 40 to 50,000 jobs over the last decade in the oil patch, and more. And more are going to be coming. So, what kind of specific things would the Pembina Institute like to see around supporting workers?
Great question. So, I mean, an obvious one there is an increased resourcing around training for workers. So, and of course, with that needs to be complemented with better labor market information. We want to have a better sense about what those growth industries are and how existing workers and their skill sets in industries where we do expect to see change, how do those line up with those opportunities? Are they in the same regions? Are they Do they require upskilling and new funding? So our work again is very much in line. We did some modeling for this blueprint that you mentioned, and our work finds that there's going to be about 2 million jobs in the clean economy available, and that's taking all account all the different kinds of changes and declines in certain industries that are modeled alongside our assumptions for the clean economy transition. So we see net growth in those industries, and it's really just making sure that there's intention behind where those training and those interventions are made to make sure they line up with workers and they cause as minimal disruption as possible. So we don't want to have to see, a million workers moving between provinces. That doesn't work, and it creates a lot of different economic challenges for communities. That's something we saw in the big cod fishery collapse out in the Atlantic provinces. So, we think the government of Canada has responsibilities there, but the provinces and territories also do as well. They hold a lot of responsibilities around education, and I think having that collaboration between those two entities is of critical importance. We also want to see things like regional development and more funding for communities, particularly those that are dependent on the resource industry. We want to have, more support for them to be able to reimagine their futures and again diversify in that way that helps them, respond more more robustly and have more cushioning against some of the volatility that we see. So the Government of Canada did announce in its emissions reduction plan a commitment to a futures fund, which would give $2 billion to fossil fuel dependent provinces like Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland and Labrador. And so we're really hopeful that we start to see more information about how that might be implemented. And ideally, we want to have supports across all of Canada for similar planning. It's not just those provinces that are going to be dealing with kinds of change, and we could really see resources distributed a lot better in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. We don't spend, we're just now beginning to wrap our arms around the labor requirements for building out power grids. So, for instance, BC Hydro a couple months ago came out with its new 10-year capital plan. I think they're going to spend $36 billion. And but that's not building generation capacity. That's is building things like transmission lines, a couple of transmission lines that need to go from east to west. And they plan to get their new generation capacity in wind and solar from indigenous communities, from independent power producers, from community solar, that kind of thing. And so who's going to build all that? People are going to have to be existing tradespeople or laborers, workers are going to have to be trained with new techniques. Some who are losing their jobs in existing hydrocarbon extraction industries are going to have to require some retraining. And rather than have a dislocated workforce where you've got shortages and employers are scrambling and you've got cost inflation and all sorts of other unintended consequences, to take a managed coordinating approach to that seems to make a whole lot of sense. And what is going to happen in BC will happen in every other province. They all have to build out their electricity systems in order to handle the switch to electrification that we all know is coming by 2050. And that's just one example of what's coming. So can you maybe give me some examples where you see new industries that are having to pivot, like the power sector, or industries that are maybe going to arise that will create new demand for workers?
Of course, we see in the budget here new funding and new planning, and I guess an industrial policy is the word that was chosen by the government of Canada to describe its plan around buildings. We want to have, again, this is where it's really, really important that we have all these different policy files and different departments coordinating on a given issue, because when it comes to buildings, we're dealing with a housing crisis, we're dealing with an affordability crisis, we're dealing with labor shortages, and we, need to make sure that our building stock is retrofit in order to reduce fewer emissions and move towards cleaner electricity sources and ensure that new builds are in line with some of the standards that we want to see. So investments in things like this apprenticeship strategy that was announced in budget 2024 yesterday are really, really hopeful. And yeah, you raise a really good point around the transmission build out and a lot of those, and the power generation being driven by Indigenous communities. And there's also a really important equity piece here because we see the current landscape of our clean energy economy and the traditional energy economy, and a lot of that is not as diverse as Canada's population. So we want to do more and make sure that, the training and kinds of investments take into consideration the concerns and needs of equity deserving groups.
I want to talk about that just a little bit in the context of carbon pricing and the Axe the Tax campaign. So, Canadians, a fairly now substantial group of Canadians, are upset about the consumer carbon tax. And the issue here, I had an interesting discussion with an economist who works in on carbon pricing quite a lot. And the point of the here's the point, and this gets to your argument about equity, that below a certain threshold, now in BC doesn't have the federal carbon tax, so you only get a rebate if your family income is below 50,000. Now imagine that you're a working community and you're working class. You got a blue collar, or maybe you got a Red Seal carpentry or something, plumber, whatever it is, and maybe you're making 60, 70, 80,000 as a family. Well, you get the consumer carbon tax stick applied to you because you pay carbon price on your gas, natural gas to heat your home. You pay it on your gasoline bill for your vehicles to get around, get to work, and so on. But that particular there's a cohort there that gets the stick but can't afford the carrots. So, for instance, if you want to put a heat pump in your home. And for us in Parksville, it was $18,000. So we had to have $10,000 or $12,000 available to us that so that we could then qualify for the government subsidies and get this project done. But what if you don't have that? What if you've got a couple kids at home and your budget's already stretched? You mentioned earlier, inflation has created an affordability and high interest rates created an affordability crisis. There's a lot of people in Canada who are kind of betwixt and between here. They're paying the tax, which sends the right signals. That's the way it should work. But they don't have the financial resources to respond in the way the government would like them to. And that's a big equity problem that we're not talking about much. So do you,
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
no, I was just going to ask, is there anything in the budget that came out yesterday that maybe addresses that question?
Yeah, I think there's lots of different design mechanisms that decision makers can use to build in more equity. But I think it's also really important to make sure that there are those strong regulatory signals that are sent out and that there is consistency applied. And once the government's committed to something, that they stick with a given path. So I'd have to speak with some of my other colleagues around sort of what came out yesterday and their thoughts on it. But I think having folks being more involved and more engaged on these issues about how to design different policies correctly to take the current context into consideration, right? We want the clean choice to be the easy choice, and good policy will achieve that.
Yeah, I think that's particularly important given the cost declines that we're expecting in some of these new technologies. We're seeing battery prices falling off a cliff. So, home storage is going to become more affordable. Electric vehicles now are kind of, we've already seen what they're doing in China. The mid-range market there around the $20,000 to $30,000 range, you get a very nice vehicle. Electric vehicle with 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000 kilometers of range. So eventually those are going to make their way to Canada, or domestic OEMs will introduce their own. But there's all of this technology that's just in the process of becoming really the low cost, the obvious low cost choice. And so we there's so much planning that needs some policy that needs to be supportive of that, and certainly a Sustainable Jobs Act and programs to help people, you know, move into those areas is going to be a big one. Is there any other another one or two areas that where you want to draw our attention to or explain about the Sustainable Jobs Act that our my listeners should know about?
Yeah, I think these action plans that we anticipate, I think there is a planned engagement on that. And so I think Canadians can really have their voices heard through that engagement process. The Government of Canada will be looking to staff up a Sustainable Jobs Partnership Council. It'll be fully independent GIC appointed folks. So any of those experts in the areas of labor or regional development should consider throwing their hat into the ring. I think, we want to make sure that there's a multi-pronged approach taken to these issues, and we want to make sure that Canada is in a good position to respond again to some of the changes that are occurring. There's a robust social security mechanisms in place, and to make sure that we're putting ourselves in a position for growth and success for workers and communities at the forefront of that. So that's my message there.
Well, look, let's close up our interview with you know, my take on this, Megan, is that we're now seeing an accelerated a period of accelerated policy development by Western governments in a variety of areas, and jobs and training is certainly a big one. And so this act, which has been stuck in the House of Commons for a year while it was being hotly debated and amended and so on, now it goes to the Senate. For folks, especially our American audience, not familiar with the Westminster form of government, it now goes over to the Senate where it'll be reviewed and it might be amended, but the amendments aren't binding on the House. So we'll see how that all plays out. But I think we can say that this legislation is going to be proclaimed as law in the very in the probably in the near future, maybe this fall, but as soon as possible, right?
Fingers crossed for that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But again, it's getting back to this is a period of rapid change, and our trading partners in the US in particular are really ramping up the speed at which they're changing. And so the faster we get after this with the most effective policy mechanisms, the bigger toolbox with the best tools, policy tools, is a very good thing. And so we hope that this will be it. So I'll leave you with the final word.
Yeah, I'll just say as well, I couldn't agree more. And for folks who are reading headlines out there about, this being a jobs killing bill, it's really not. There's nothing in there that's going to take away any jobs. It's really just putting in place the mechanisms for government to plan for the future and have workers at the table. And I really hope that that's not too threatening of an idea for folks. I think, it makes our process more democratic. It really shines a light on some important issues, and it brings together two really important pieces of the labor and economy and environment. So, yeah, well, can't wait to see what happens over the next little while in the Senate here too. So
Well, Megan, thank you very much for this. Good to see you again. And I no doubt we'll have you on in the near future to talk about there's some other bills wending their way through and policies that'll be announced. So thank you very much for this.
thanks so much, Mark. I'm great to chat.